Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes. This is Zero Point Teachings on BBS Radio. I welcome you back if you're a repeat listener, and I hope we have some new listeners on board today. My name is Christopher Holmes. I work under the logos of Zero Point, which is an institute for mystical and spiritual science. I live just south of Ottawa, Ontario, and I work full-time at my writings and maintaining my website and trying to promote this Zero Point teaching. I'm interested in both science and mysticism, and have studied widely in both and arrived at a unique synthesis of these two areas of ideas and teachings. Through my life, I've studied widely as in modern psychology and science, as well as in the Gurdjieff Uspensky teachings, the yogic Vedic teachings of India, Kabbalah and Judaism, and most importantly, the secret doctrine of H.P. Blavatsky. I'm interested in the physics and metaphysics of creation, and through this program, I explain this unique understanding of what we are as human beings. I'm presenting a multidimensional model of the nature of human consciousness and human existence. I'm suggesting, in line with Blavatsky, that all human beings essentially have a zero-point source, that in a way, to understand the human being, we have to understand that zero-point nature. And this zero-point dynamics in the human being are connected, most importantly, to the heart center. So to understand the zero-point dynamics is related to the human heart. In my view, a human being is far deeper than what is considered by modern science, which assumes we have no spirit or soul or divine nature. And modern science for the past century has dismissed investigations of the mysteries of out-of-body experiences, psychokinesis, different lives, afterlife, all these mysteries of human existence. And so modern science is completely unable to explain or account for these type of phenomena. However, the existence of all of these phenomena point to the necessity of a whole alternative understanding of what is human consciousness. In this series, I hope as people listen over time, you'll appreciate and understand more and more what I share. This is not an easy teaching for me to simply elaborate this zero-point teaching. It simply can't be done without taking into account people's wrong understandings and so many other contrary other ideas. I'm trying to explain certain secret esoteric hidden teachings, occult teachings, that are found throughout the sacred literature of the world. So these aren't ideas to be simply grasped. And further, it's not simply understanding these ideas with our mind, but then further we have to go beyond that to experience what I'm talking about. To actually have experiences of what's being explained. Most importantly, I begin with investigations of human consciousness, and I'm highly critical of the whole mainstream of modern psychology and new age philosophizing. Both of these dominant themes in these areas are to assume that human consciousness is produced mainly or only in the mind, in the head of a human being. I call this the head doctrine. In modern times, anyone can have a study or book on human consciousness and simply put a head on the front cover and it's supposed to be scientific. What I'm trying to explain, as elaborated within the spiritual teachings of humanity, is that human consciousness, and the I experience originates out of the depths of your own hearts. It is not produced by the mind, and consciousness is not produced by material processes. Instead, there is a higher dimensional physics whereby light and our inner, we have an inner nature that's actually within the quantum vacuum and within the zero point fields. Now, I try to explain these as I go along, what I mean by these concepts. But there's a whole inner world to the human heart. The heart is not simply a material thing, but the heart is where the higher dimensional nature connects into the physical body. A human being is ensouled through the heart. That's why we talk of the heart and soul. So consciousness is connected to the idea of understanding consciousness is connected to understanding the mysteries of the heart and soul. Whereas modern science accepts the head doctrine, even though no one can explain where consciousness is produced by the brain or what it is, and despite the fact that this has no connection to what a inner self-experience shows us, that is accepted so widely within our times. Even Deepak Chopra in the book How to Know God says that seven ways of knowing God all involve seven levels of the human brain. This is totally contrary to the esoteric teachings of humanity. The heart doctrine, as I show in my book called The Heart Doctrine, is in mystical Christianity, Judaism, Islam and Sufism, and Hinduism, and Tibetan Buddhism and Buddhism. In addition, it is within the Blavatsky secret doctrine and the teachings of theosophy, and it's hidden in the Gurdjieff teaching. It's a hidden element in that teaching. So to understand this heart doctrine is most important from a scientific viewpoint, and then individually in our lives, we want somehow to learn to live in the heart, our everyday being existence. So we try to remind ourselves to come practice self-remembering, to come back to ourselves and being present here now and being aware of yourself in the world and what's happening around you. And deepening your breath and cultivating being more awake and present within your life circumstance. So we try to make an effort to cultivate that and cultivate the awakening of the heart. One yogi defines yoga as involving the dissolution of the false mind into the lotus of the heart. Well, the heart is a very deep lotus indeed. It is like a flower that is rooted into the quantum vacuum, into the zero-point fields, and ultimately to a vacated space. There's a higher dimensional physics and metaphysics to a human being. The physical heart is not only a physical heart, there's a psychical heart, a spiritual heart, and a divine heart. The divine element, so the heart, it is itself a multidimensional entity. So even when a person dies and the physical heart dies, your life is maintained within the psychical, spiritual, and divine. You are already within all of these interpenetrating layers. It's simply that our consciousness becomes more and more conditioned by the physical nature and the needs and desires of the body and such, and our personal emotional lives, so that we don't realize these higher dimensional aspects to ourselves. So we have to cultivate remembering ourselves to be present and try to experience what we are in our being. And as we do that, we can have experiences of the heart opening as a lotus. It can open the heart or you can close the heart. As people go through trauma and difficult experiences in their lives, they contract about the heart. And those knots of the heart then have to be undone in order for a person to experience self-realization. So I'm trying to give these teachings about consciousness and the heart, and then at the same time elaborate different aspects of the physics and metaphysics of the zero-point teaching. Not only takes a aspect on my behalf of being able to try to explain these ideas simply, but also on the reader, the listener, to cultivate over time to understand and appreciate more the things that are being said. It's hard to fully grasp the significance of things. Last week, we had the second part of a two-week program on the secret doctrine of H.P. Blavatsky. And I tried to explain some of the ideas from the secret doctrine published in 1888 and comparing that with modern ideas in physics over a century later. Now, in her day, Blavatsky expected no one to take seriously what she wrote in the secret doctrine, as it was so contrary to what was understood in science and common thought. But she predicted that a century later we would realize the profound significance of what she had explained within this book, The Secret Doctrine. One point, most importantly, or one quotation from The Secret Doctrine states, "Material points without extension, zero points, are the materials by which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies." This actually suggests that all living beings have a zero-point center, that you have a center that's tied into this deep physics of the universe. And that zero-point center, you actually have different bodies that surround that zero-point center. When you come into space, Blavatsky explains that space is seven-dimensional, so we really have seven bodies, and we can exist upon seven major planes of being. So we really are multidimensional beings, and we come down into the physical body. But at our death, when the physical body dies, the consciousness is still there, the heart is still present, and the feelings. And you have awareness and existence on other planes of being because you're still clothed all the time in different bodies, interpenetrating one another. Science thinks we're only the physical body, but there's no evidence for this. So I'm trying to explain, in a way, the higher dimensional origins of consciousness by explaining an alternate way of looking at the physics of a human being. In modern science, we have quantum theory, and if we consider a human being as a quantum system, the center of that is the human heart. The electromagnetic volume of the heart is estimated to be 5,000 times the electromagnetic volume of the brain in the head. So the heart is truly the center of a human being. Blavatsky explains that the suns expand and contract through their own selves and hearts. And similarly, we do. Life comes into the body at conception. The Dalai Lama explains 72,000 channels grow out from the heart, all the veins and arteries and channels. And at death, all the energies gather again into the zero-point center within the heart, and the soul leaves the body, or the body is separated from the soul nature. So this trying to understand that ultimately a human being, at the heart of being, there is described as being a form of nothingness. There's nothingness at the heart of being. In a way, we all come out of that nothingness and we'll all return to that nothingness. In between, there's this profound mystery play going on, and we're all beings lost in time and space, living in ignorance of ourselves, living in ignorance of what we really are as beings, how we are multidimensional beings and have come down into this body. So we want to cultivate a knowledge and understanding of that. So last week was on some aspects of Blavatsky and trying to explain the concept of zero points and how Blavatsky explains really the seven zero points She explains all the laws of physics in terms of the dynamics involving 7 zero-point holes dug in space. And this all occurs in the higher dimensional ether. And it's through these holes dug in space that these beings on higher dimensions inform material creation. That the gods and other invisible powers in higher dimensions, they act through zero-point centers to bring life into a human being. So we all have such a zero-point center. Avinov, one mystic, says that circle with a point in its center, he says, is a symbol of the initiate. He says, I've searched my whole life to find this center. It is within us, and we have to find it. Actually, a human being has 7 chakras, and each has a zero-point center, and all ultimately dissolve into the zero-point center of the heart. So there's this interior, higher-dimensional physics that goes on within the human being. The scientists can't see it because it's a non-material thing. It exists within different dimensional electromagnetic fields of different frequency domains and ranges. We don't really understand the nature of what space is at all in modern science. None of the scientists who study consciousness consider that they have to consider the nature of space. Consciousness exists within space. How are we to understand this? Anyway, last week I enjoyed the shows on Blavatsky, and it renewed. I made an effort since to be getting back to my writing on Blavatsky, and I'm revising my book, The Divine Mysteries, and I hope to revise that and maybe make it available in a month or two, and maybe do another show and come back to Blavatsky. There's really so much to it that when I myself make an effort to teach it, I kind of realize and learn so much more and try to get a better grasp on the significance of her teaching. She says at one point, the swift and radiant one produces the 7 Laya centers and seats the universe on these eternal foundations. And what I tried to do last week was explain that this is so similar to the newest concepts in holographic theory. Well, actually, I didn't get to holographic theory. I talked more about M theory and string theory. And the idea in string theory that at every point in space there is a 7-dimensional Kalabi Yao element. And this is like, there's this higher dimensional element, Kalubi Yao space, existent at every point underlying 4-dimensional space-time. And what I try to do is explain, that's what Blavatsky is saying, that there are these elements, these 7-dimensional zero-point dynamics that occur down on a level beyond perception. So Blavatsky's ideas are most similar to the newest ideas in M theory and string theory, and then in holographic theory, I didn't even get to this. One of the ideas in holographic theories, the way I would interpret it, it suggests that an element in a higher dimensional space or hyperspace, the physics of that element can correspond to a whole alternative physics manifest in the physical worlds around, that there's an equivalency of physics. Now, what I'm trying to say here, imagine for a moment that you have a triune and sevenfold monadic essence, this element that exists within hyperspace. And that element in hyperspace has all these intrinsic rays and streamings. It's a spark, a divine spark of light and this element. And it exists in higher dimensional space. And its spin properties, sp- spin a web around it so that bodies materialize around the central point. So that's how the point is kind of clothed in different bodies surrounding it. And those bodies relate to different zero-point fields that are latent within the quantum vacuum. The quantum vacuum has an inherent sevenfold nature. Okay, so so I'm saying the idea then is that the spin properties of a monadic essence in hyperspace can the physics, the metaphysics of that in high dimensional physics can then manifest as what occurs within the physics of the material creation. So in a way, Blavatsky says you take any physics far enough, it leads to metaphysics. Well, the point at which the physics leads to metaphysics is when you cross the zero point. Because all physics goes so far to the zero point, and then the uncertainty principle prevents us from seeing further into the root principles of creation. It is what Blavatsky calls a ring pass knot, that you can't penetrate. It becomes unfathomable, she says, beyond the zero point level. Any finite thing traced far enough dissolves into the infinite, and this is all through zero-point dynamics. Now, these zero-point teachings are very complicated to understand, and there's many aspects to my work as a psychologist, as a scientist, and as a mystic. I will introduce all kinds of material through this program over time, and I've over the last 3 or 4 or 5 shows, I've had a guest with me, James A. Moffat, who is online at the moment in the background, and I'll introduce Jim in a moment. I've known Jim since high school in grade 11. I remember him, what a good history student he was. I particularly remembered that. And then through our lives, I'm 56 years old now, so over the past 40 years, I've had association with Jim once we started going to university and sharing interests in the nature of science and philosophy and reality and other things. So Jim's known and seen my work change and through different phases through my life and has a broader overview of my life and history. So I thought today, and he appreciates more so than anyone else other than associate Karen here, just where my work stands compared to other ideas and teachings and influences in modern times. So over this week and then again next week, and we may carry it on further, Jim is going to actually take over as the interview and interview me. And before we go on to that, that will be the main focus of today's show. Before I go on to that, I didn't mean to make a few announcements, even though I kind of got waylaid a little bit once I get talking here. I do invite listeners to have a look at my website, www.zeropoint.ca. I do invite you to email me during the show or afterwards at christopherholmes@rogers.com. I do encourage people to order my books, this series I've done called the Within Without from Zero Point series. And the first is on the heart doctrine, all about the mysteries and enigmas of consciousness and the heart. And the second is entitled Microcosm, Macrocosm, explaining how both individual consciousness and the universe both originate from zero point sources. And I explore and compare modern physics to Blavatsky and Kabbalah and such. These are really quite unique books. At the moment, I'm putting a special on. You can get both books for $70, which includes mailing. that you can, information is available on my website if you're interested. Okay, the next show will be 2 weeks from today, and it'll be a continuation of today's show. So with that, I'd like to call on Jim. Are you there in the background?
I am.
Okay, Jim. Well, I'm going to shut up for a moment and take a break, and we'll turn it over to you, and you can introduce just how you'd like to run the interview or begin wherever you'd like.
Well, actually, I was going to say, I think you were doing so well that I'm a little reluctant to come on. That was a pretty interesting presentation the first half hour. You covered a lot of material.
Yeah, thanks. It's funny, as I
You seem a little wound up today. Sorry.
I get into it sometimes. It just flows. I just see it. It's just all so sensible and intelligible to me, over time. And I felt that. So sometimes I get off. I don't know what I'm going to say ahead of time. But as I understand it more and more deeply, I can explain it more succinctly and get directly to the point. So I'm trying to make an effort to do that.
Yeah, I don't know if you heard me laugh when you made reference to the fact that anybody can write a book on consciousness today and put a picture of a brain on the cover and it's considered to be scientific. But because I'm holding in my hand a book called Conversations on Consciousness, and the subtitle is "Let the Best Minds Think About the Brain, Free Will, and What It Means to Be Human," and it's put together by Susan Blackmore, who's a British psychologist, well-known British psychologist, who at one point I think was very interested in paranormal phenomena, and has actually come to the conclusion that she's very skeptical now and doesn't really, I think, believe in paranormal phenomena, but. Anyway, she put this book together, and I'll just say that from the inside jacket, it says that some of the interviewees are major philosophers, such as John Searle, Ned Block, and David Chalmers, and some are equally renowned scientists, Francis Crick, Roger Penrose, V.S. Ramachandran. All of them talk candidly with Blackmore about some of the key philosophical issues confronting us in a series of conversations that are revealing, insightful, and stimulating. They ruminate on the nature of consciousness. Is it something apart from the brain? Is it even possible to understand the brain to understand consciousness? Some of these thinkers say no, it isn't possible, but most believe that they will pierce the mystery surrounding consciousness and that neuroscience will provide the key. Blackmore goes beyond the issue of consciousness to ask other intriguing questions. Is there free will? If no, how does this affect the way you live your life? And more broadly, how has your work changed the way you live? So that's the most important thinkers in the world today about consciousness, according to this book. And actually, there's a picture of two brains on the cover, so I guess this is twice as good as most books. But there's a brain on the top, and then there's a brain on the bottom, and there's an arrow.
Do they actually say that they're ruminating about it?
They're ruminating about it, yeah, which I believe to ruminate is what a cow does when it chews its cud. I mean,
well, it's funny because whenever I think of psychologists ruminating about consciousness, and you know, if you connect consciousness to blood flow, you can just see all the blood going up into the brain more and more. So the more you think about consciousness, the more you end up thinking that consciousness consists in thinking and the minding, and then you come to esoteric teachings and they say higher states of consciousness you experience them once you begin to neutralize the incessant turning of the mind, the monkeys of the mind, or the vritti, Yogananda calls them, thought waves. So it's like, see, the idea of higher consciousness is like getting beyond this whole level of the mind and the ruminating and so on. That's neat that you had that new book there. I wasn't familiar with that.
I actually have a copy for you too because I thought you'd be interested in it. But as I say, in all esoteric disciplines, one of the most formidable obstacles to the development of consciousness, and everybody I think notices this when they try to meditate, is that you just cannot stop your mind. Your mind is is acting mechanically without your control. And all, anybody who's ever tried to meditate finds out that what happens is that you set out to either empty your mind and just sit still, or to focus on a mantra or whatever, and after a while, all of a sudden you realize, oh, I'm thinking about something, and it just happens automatically and mechanically. And so, as you say, when psychologists consider consciousness, they start out and they think, well, what is consciousness? And they think about it, and then they think, well, consciousness is thinking. I mean, that's the main equation that's made today in consciousness studies and in academic circles anyways. And of course, this is exactly contrary to what esoteric teachings do.
Yeah, where it's a much basic being, existence awareness, pure existence awareness beingness,
yeah.
Beyond the turning of the mind and the thoughts. And yeah, it's something far, far deeper in the structures of our being.
So what would you put on the cover of a picture, as a picture of a book on consciousness?
Well, you know the picture I have on microcosm, macrocosm.
Why don't you describe that?
That shows, it's centered on the lotus of the heart, and it shows a man in yogi position and three-dimensional Star of David drawn around it, connecting that being to the universe, as like the center of the universe within the heart. That's the main image on microcosm, macrocosm.
Which,
so that's what I would use. It's like where I did that critique of the Scientific American article where they asked, are you a hologram? And on the cover of Scientific American, they had a sphere drawn around a person's brain, and they just had the head on the cover of Scientific American, asking if you're a hologram. So it's like, are you a hologram? But we're only going to take a little bit of you that we want to be the head part. But if you took a human being, I would say, is a hologram of the whole, that you have to take the whole human being, not just the head. It's kind of so funny, they just assume that it's all around the head.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess before I start to ask you a few questions here, I was just going to say that, as you said, we've known one another for, I guess it's 40 years, I mean, I can't believe you're that old, but I guess in 1976, when we were both graduate students in psychology, you discovered the fourth way of Gurdjieff and Uspensky and began to study that, and eventually incorporated those ideas into your doctoral dissertation. And I've helped you with that work as your research assistant, and then incorporated the same ideas into my master's thesis in psychology. And from that time on, we've been studying esoteric material now for some 30 years. And even though we worked together at various times, you've kind of gone on. This has been your main preoccupation. I've written about Gurdjieff Uspensky material mainly, and you've gone on to develop a model of consciousness and which is derived from a variety of esoteric sources, as you said, not just Gurdjieff, but also Madame Blavatsky and the Vedas and the Upanishads and the Sufism and a variety of esoteric sources. And in the last couple of years, reading your work, especially your Within Without series and specifically the first book, The Heart Doctrine, I came to a new appreciation of where your work had gone. I sort of followed it along and I realized in considering it, well, a couple of things. First of all, it just confirmed my belief that I think that you're the most important theorist writing about consciousness today, that I know of. I'm fairly familiar with most of the people who consider consciousness and their ideas, and I think your perspective is incredibly interesting and unique synthesis of mystical and scientific teachings and brought together in ways that I don't think anybody else addresses. And I think it really addresses some extremely important, essential issues in that confront both scientists and those who follow mystical or esoteric paths in an attempt to know themselves and to wake up and to realize what in essence they are. So there's that. I am extremely interested in your work because it's just so interesting. But then the other part of it all that really interests me and has now made me want to write a book about your entire journey and your work is that one of the things that, and people who have listened to earlier programs will have heard me say this already, but one of the things that really bothers me is when I read criticisms of mysticism and people who claim to be mystics from usually from scientists, but also from others who are skeptical about mystical claims. What you hear over and over again is that mysticism is some sort of a retreat or a cop-out for people who are intellectually inferior or who indulge in self-aggrandizement and really don't have the chops to undertake the discipline and the intellectual challenges of science. That's exactly what Stephen Hawking, for example, says, is mysticism is a cop-out. And you hear this over and over again. And having spent 30 years studying this material and myself and watching you work at this pretty much exclusively for the last 30 years, that strikes me as being the most idiotic and completely unfounded idea that I can imagine. Because once you begin to study mystical and esoteric teachings and you realize the profound nature of this material, you realize that to understand it is you're never really going to completely understand it, and there's always something that you can learn. And it's one of the great things about undertaking this is that the journey is in and of itself so rewarding, so stimulating, so inspiring, so intriguing that it's everything that I think that what people who practice science get out of science. It's the wonder of knowing. It's the wonder of discovery. It's the wonder of the mysteries of the nature of ourselves and the universe. And so one of the things that I want to undertake when I write this book, which is tentatively entitled The Problem of God's Contracting Universe, which is I see as the, we'll get to that later, but that's the sort of the overview I would, term I would apply to your work. And something along the lines of the subtitle would be The Odyssey of Dr. Christopher Holmes's Journey as a Mystic Scientist, something along those lines. And what I want to explore is the journey and show that really, you know, in developing these ideas, and they're not specifically your ideas, these are ideas derived from the mystical and esoteric teachings, but you put them together in what I said earlier, what I think is a unique synthesis. And so I want to describe that process and show that, you know, these people who think that this is somehow the retreat of those who are intellectually inferior have absolutely no idea what they're talking about. And I think that will become very evident. As you say, when you try to present your ideas of the zero-point teaching, this can't be grasped by anybody all at once. It's a process. It takes study, it takes reflection, it takes renewal of effort, and it's a process that takes many years. And it's rewarding intellectually in and of itself, but it's much more rewarding in terms of informing one as to what the nature of one's being is and the miraculous possibilities inherent in our nature. So that's essentially, those are the two main concerns I have in addressing your work. So what I would like to do in these next few programs is try to trace that arc and review your career, and we'll talk about some of the elements of the process, and we'll talk about a lot of the ideas that you've discovered and how you've put things together, because I think that's very interesting in and of itself too, some of the connections that you've made.
Yep. I, you're fading a lot. I'm not sure if it's coming through elsewhere. I don't know. Were you talking in the phone?
Yeah.
There, you're back strong again.
Oh, okay.
You were fading from, I wasn't hearing you well.
Maybe a bit of a problem with my cord here. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Let me know if I go out again. Anyway,
okay.
So I guess the first question I have is that on your website and on your books, when your autobiographical notes, you describe yourself as a mystic scientist, and I think most people would consider that. I know I've heard people react to that by saying that's something of an oxymoron, isn't it, to be a mystic scientist? And I guess there must be a story there. So why don't you tell me a little bit about how you came to regard yourself as a mystic scientist?
Well, I Yeah, I guess that was many, many years over that evolved over a long time period, because when I was a graduate student in psychology and my main interest was the development of consciousness in psychotherapy, and I was interested in the idea that people had to develop self-consciousness instead of being in the normal state, which Gurdjieff describes as being a waking sleep, where we're kind of semi-conscious but fully conditioned and attached to everything. So I thought psychotherapy involves not only bringing the unconscious into consciousness, as Freud described, but then further, that there were further states of development of consciousness and attaining self-consciousness, whatever that might be. So I was interested in that, and I was, you know, studying social psychology and clinical psychology, and a friend mentioned a book by by Uspensky, who explains the Gurdjieff teaching. And he said that he talked a lot about self-consciousness and self-observation and self-remembering and the study of consciousness. So that was my first introduction. That was the first esoteric book I had ever read. I guess I was about 24 or something at the time. The Fourth Way is what I read initially. And as soon as I began reading that book, I felt that this is knowledge of a different order. Like this person, the way he talks, he knows how it was a knowledge of a different order in a way. And even I remember the first page of The Fourth Way, Uspensky says, if this book were just about my theories, like Mr. P.D. Uspensky, it wouldn't be important. But this isn't about my ideas. This is kind of about this teaching represented by Gurdjieff and this Fourth Way esoteric tradition. So then some of the Fourth Way work is just so brilliant compared to anything I had learned or was learning in modern psychology. And it always transcended. It was always a far broader perspective and understanding. And I could understand how Gurdjieff says that we live in the Tower of Babel. Everyone has different words and languages and you have wrong understanding and things, and no one really understands anything. I could understand that more and more. And so there was, you know, at that point, I still wouldn't have considered myself a mystic scientist. You know, it was through the years. So I began studying the Gurdjieff work and working on myself to become more conscious and to wake up in my life and to observe myself, to differentiate my thinking and feeling and sensation. So studying myself inwardly as a being with the idea of striving to wake up and be more conscious. So that over years, as you practice that, that brings about effects in you. Like certain things drop away from your life and you're not as interested in, and you're clearer, and you begin to live a richer, fuller life through the practice of self-remembering. So even through all those early magical times, I still wouldn't have considered myself a mystic scientist. It was really later, you know, I went on to study the yogic Vedic teachings and Blavatsky. It's more after Blavatsky and studying more modern physics. Then over time, it was over 25 years almost, you know, maybe 5 years ago, I really began to understand mystic science. Mystical science is a higher level of science. It's a science number 4, Gurdjieff says, or Uspensky says. He explains a science as a science of a man number 1, 2, or 3. But to really understand the mysteries, we have to have this whole new paradigm of science. And most important is the study of human consciousness, because we can't understand the world without understanding our inner nature and inner being. So Uspensky said there's this higher science, but this higher science is based on the development of consciousness. You see, we can't attain this deeper understanding unless we attain a deeper level of consciousness, because your level of understanding and knowledge is conditioned and limited by your level of consciousness. I remember Nicole or someone giving the story about a philosopher, a theologian, a professor who writes about the unity of creation, and meanwhile he kind of fails to realize when he irritates his wife, and he's angry when he gets shortchanged, and he's subject to all the usual proclivities of an individual in their life. So how can you search for unity, he said, unless you attain a different level of consciousness wherein you're unified yourself? That a human being has so many different aspects to themselves, they're not unified. They don't know. Yeah, so we have to... the more and more through my life and then just having different mystical experiences, they all kind of deepened in the understanding until I came to the point where now I see, when we talk about science, I think there is a fundamental way in which modern science has been a huge pseudoscience, a huge, gross, colossal error in modern thought, the denial of spirit and soul and the failure to look at subtle influences and forces in nature and life. And they've done that for, Blavatsky says, no one has looked at the occult side of nature. And all those scientists who dismiss all these things, they themselves are like totally pseudoscientific. Firstly, they don't understand what they're dismissing. They don't consider all the areas of evidence. They haven't had their own experiences which show them otherwise. So, I've lost my train of thought a little bit here.
You were just trying to explain how you...
Well, yeah, the sequence of coming to the being a mystic scientist. So I realized the idea. So it was really, you know, a 25-year process to really understand that fully, what that is, mystical sciences. And it's not that what I study as a mystic scientist is incompatible with science. No. I take the evidences and theories of science and interpret them within a different framework of understanding. And I use the facts of science as evidence to support the mystical claims and conceptions of the nature of reality. For example, like, take the periodic tables of chemistry and take the nature of the material world. What is basic nature of the material world? Well, the world is composed of protons, electrons, and neutrons, and these elements, these atoms, form into seven rows of elements in the periodic tables. Okay, so Blavatsky teaches also everything in creation, there's always a triunity of forces, and that there are seven planes of existence, and each of those seven planes of existence has seven subplanes of existence. So if we take the physical plane of existence as having seven rows of elements on the periodic tables, well, that actually confirms the hypothesis based on Blavatsky's secret doctrine. Further, if you study Blavatsky, I would postulate that hyperspace or the quantum vacuum has an inherent sevenfold nature. So that would be a prediction. And the newest models of the nature of hyperspace are seven-dimensional models. So I came to realize more and more in the study of the esoteric tradition is that these are truly scientific ideas if we know how to synthesize them with science and reinterpret the facts of science. It's like re-enchanting science, just like we talk about re-enchantment of the world. Well, science has denied spirit and soul, afterlife, other dimensions, all these things for 100 years, and they think that's scientific, but really it's just this mode of ignorance that people have fallen into in the conditioned state of consciousness. And they're all a little bit scientists. Most scientists are just have expertise in about one quanta, one element or theoretical variable within some subdivision of a discipline within the department. And everyone, they're all scientists of little bits. was to aim for mystical science. We have to try to have a framework within which we can synthesize different bits of human knowledge, and that's what's lacking in modern science. So mysticism in science is a whole where we take the facts of science, what's so valuable there, and we compare and interpret them in terms of mystical ideas. So it's really been a long, long process to come to the point that I understand it as I do so much more clearly today. So yeah, so mystical science is we normally, Gurdjieff explains, we see things dualistically, like science and religion. Well, the third force is mystical science, which synthesizes the elements in science and religion. But no one's known how to frame these issues in ways. So I see mystical science, it's this third force kind of, which will synthesize science and mysticism and bring about the re-enchantment of science and re-enchantment of nature, kind of wake up to self-realization of soul forces in your life, what's really going on, like waking up. So it's been a long process. That's a long story. I went on quite a long time. But it's neat to think of it. I'd never thought of that because I call myself that. But how did that evolve? That was a long time in coming, really, to develop that fully.
I thought it was a very good answer. You said about 15 things that I'd like to follow up on, but I guess I just wanted to take you back a little bit because you were commenting on the first esoteric material you read. You had read The Fourth Way by Uspensky about the Gurdjieff's teaching, and at the same time, when you got into that, you introduced it to me at the same time, and I remember the type of thing that you just said, that I think I started with In Search of the Miraculous, which describes in Russia in 1915, I guess, from 1915 to 1917, when Uspensky was an intellectual and a theorist and someone who was quite schooled in esoterica and had been a prominent member of the Theosophical Society, and he had met Gurdjieff, who appeared in Moscow to give lectures and was introduced to the Fourth Way teaching that Gurdjieff said he had discovered in his own spiritual search, and claimed that it was an ancient teaching that had disappeared for thousands of years, but he had rediscovered, and he started to present it to Uspensky. And Uspensky's initial reaction, despite all the strange ways in which Gurdjieff behaved and seemed to be putting on a big act for purposes that he couldn't quite decipher, but his reaction was that he had met a man who knew. And I remember reading that book, and when I first read it, I went through it very slowly. I just didn't sort of read it all in one fell swoop. And I remember thinking what you said, that this was thought of another order, and that when a lot of the book consists of Gurdjieff's lectures on various topics, which Uspensky reproduced. He didn't take notes. He reproduced them later. It's a great feat of journalism, if nothing else, for him to reproduce these lectures. And I remember reading them and thinking that this is somebody who knows, that that all these other people that I was reading, all these philosophers and psychologists, there was something quite startlingly different about this, that they were wiseacring on some level, but that this guy really knew what he was talking about. And I remember having these conversations with you and just being completely bowled over by the import of these ideas. And I guess one of the things that really appealed to me, and I think appealed to you, was that Gurdjieff's psychological ideas started with the idea that we don't know ourselves, but in order to know ourselves, we have to study ourselves, but we have to study ourselves systematically in terms of a teaching, that to study oneself sort of willy-nilly without any kind of system is completely useless, and the teaching he was presenting was designed to do that. And so why don't you talk a little bit just about your initial reaction to studying yourself systematically and how that changed your ideas about what the nature of psychology was and about what the nature of self was.
Wow, what a beautiful question, because that is so much exactly where it all began, in a way. Because one of the things first struck me about in Uspensky was his definition of psychology has to involve self-study. And I realized that nothing I had ever studied in psychology had ever mentioned the idea of self-study. It was learning all these different theories and statistics and social ideas and all these things about things, outer things, but no one in any area ever suggested that we had to study ourselves and cultivate awareness of ourselves to understand psychology. So it was so totally contrary to the whole of modern academic scientific psychology. There is no self-study. So Uspensky was saying, this is a different kind of psychology. And my early writing on this material, I elaborated what I called Uspensky's definitions of psychology, which are in the book, Psychological Illusions. And through his writing, I extracted 8 definitions of psychology where he says psychology has to involve. And this whole teaching of this new psychology. So one of them was we have to study ourselves. Secondly, we have to study consciousness within ourselves, and we have to study consciousness. And now in academic scientific psychology, consciousness has been ignored for the last century because it's too elusive phenomena and it's too borders on philosophy and religion. So people have avoided the study of consciousness, where Uspensky put it absolutely first, that we are asleep as human beings and that we can wake up out of this conditioning state and experience these higher dimensions or levels or states of ourself. We can cultivate and develop these. He said psychology involves the psychology of man's possible evolution. Now, I've come through Western psychology. The only kind of evolution I'd ever heard of was the monkey the man business. But Uspensky says he's not talking about the monkey the man business. He calls it that. So he's not simply talking about physical evolution like that, and he says we have a completely erroneous understanding even of that. But he says he's talking of man's possible evolution, and he doesn't mean the evolution of your body into new forms of material body, but the actual growth of your inner being bodies. That we have higher dimensional being bodies, the soul and the spiritual nature, and we even have a divine nature. So we can evolve in our own awakening of consciousness and the development of these higher being bodies. So that's an inner alchemy. That's an inner alchemy of consciousness and being that can occur within the human being. And there's a whole science to this and the transformations of energy that this involves. So that was profound. So Uspensky said, we have to begin with consciousness studies. We have to study ourselves. We have to study ourselves with the idea of evolution, of the awakening and developing new powers within ourselves. So a fourth definition, he says, we have to work with self-remembering. Self-remembering is a practice that I learned from Uspensky that has changed my life. For the last 30 or plus years, I've made efforts through my life to remember, to come back to the idea of self-remembering and being present and trying to be aware of where I am and experiencing myself and studying myself. So I've done that through the last 30 years, and that in itself brings about transformations in your inner being self-awareness, how you experience what life is. Okay, so what was the last definition I gave?
Was self-remembering.
Oh, yeah, so we have to self-remember, and we're trying to study consciousness. Uspensky says, and we have to understand that we're not properly conscious. So self-remembering is a practice as we go about our life. We make a conscious effort to wake up and be more fully conscious. that we actually make an effort. Like if you want to develop your physical muscles, you go out and you go do exercises, you develop your body. Well, you want to self-remember, you got to go out and you do it about your life, anywhere, anytime. You make this effort to enhance your being self-awareness, to still the turning of your mind, to become aware of your personal emotions and try to let them go and maintain your presence. You work on yourself in all these inner ways that we're taught in the fourth way. So, and this all becomes part of your life then, of self-remembering and having experiences of awakening more and more, and the different kinds of experiences that can occur, and insights and such. The fifth definition of psychology, we have to study language because everybody uses language differently and you have to have a precise language. It's just like in modern psychology is a completely imprecise, chaotic language. People confuse the mind and consciousness. All the thinking is dualistic as though there's only the left brain, right brain, or conscious, unconscious, the stimulus and response. All the dualities of modern thought are so superficial. So we need to have a new and more precise language. Okay. And next point is that the psychology has to involve a study of the fundamental cosmic laws, and these are the laws of 3 and 7. Now, when I first heard this idea 30 years ago, I had to suspend judgment on it because it seemed, how could you have a law in the number, like a law of 3? I mean, I've heard the law of gravity or electromagnetic force, but not a law in the number, and I couldn't have conceived the profound nature of such a concept, but I do now. And the laws of 3 and 7 are fundamental principles that we can find throughout the esoteric teachings of humanity. So there must be something important about these laws of 3 and 7. They must. It's in Kabbalah, it's in Blavatsky, it's a central piece in Gurdjieff. It's in Sufism, it's in all the esoteric traditions that hints at these profound idea of the laws of 3 and 7, that these somehow are the geometric or mathematical means by which a one, a God, kind of manifests or creates reality through these principles of the triune and sevenfold nature of all things. Just like the material world is triune and sevenfold. And then light itself, it's triune in nature. It's electro, it's magnetic, and then it propagates along the pointer, the zero point center. So light is triune in nature, and you divide light by a prism, you got 7 colors. It's also triune and sevenfold. The division of white light by a triune prism into spectrum of 7 colors. That's the law of 1, 3, and 7 manifests right there in front of your eyes in light. But no one thinks that the numbers have anything to do with it. They don't see how these concepts might be used and applied. So I began to understand the laws of 3 and 7 and apply them to anything or everything I read and kind of understood and experienced. And I began to see how Gurdjieff explains people in ordinary life are third force blind. They consider things always dualistically, as though there's only the left brain and the right brain, or the head and the heart, or science or religion, all these life and death, being, non-being, the material, the immaterial. They always think dualistically, whereas if to understand any phenomena, you have to cultivate thinking in terms of 1, 3, and 7, those principles of creation. Now, at the time, I could apply that to psychology. There were profound applications of it to psychology, because Gurdjieff had a profound teaching of the 7 centers within the human being. Now, I, as a psychologist, the modern psychology is defined as the science of behavior and the mind, dualistic, because you have the mind in the head, and it's attached to a body. Like, that's really very brilliant of modern psychology. After 100 years, they've come to the mind and the body. And now people wonder how those are interconnected. So now they think the two parts are interconnected. Okay, so it's still dualistic. So in the Gurdjieff teaching, you have a system of first the human being has a triune nature. You function mentally, emotionally, and physically. And each of those three natures has a center in one story or level of your being. Your intellectual center is in your head. Your emotional center is in your chest and heart. And your physical center is below your navel in the base of your body, more involves your lower nature. Your can be your gut, your abdomen, and your whole lower physical nature, below the heart and lungs. Physical nature includes sexual nature. So a human being functions mentally, emotionally, and physically. And I could see right away psychology ignored the whole nature of emotions. They don't regard emotion as an independent, separate from the mind and the body. They confuse it. This is a basic babble in modern times. Everyone thinks their mind and body, and they don't know how to fit emotions in. Whereas in Gurdjieff, it's explained, head, heart, hands, thinking, feeling, doing. So I began to learn, realize, and observe myself to differentiate these three parts of my being and what role they played in my life, like what the emotions were and how the mind worked and observations of the mind and how it went on and considered things and so on, and then be aware of what my physical nature is. And Gurdjieff encourages us, we have to develop as a three-brain being, head, heart, and hands. We have to develop in all three areas to try to balance those three elements enough us in order to go through a transformation and attain this higher level of a man number four, this higher level of individual development. So this, in the Gurdjieff teaching, then we have a triune nature, head, heart, and hands, and that corresponds to the three gunas, or the modes of nature in yoga, that all things have an intellectual, energetic, and material nature. Now, even there, if you see modern science, they think there's only matter and energy, and matter and energy can be converted into each other. But they are third force blind. They fail to see the intelligence which is hidden within the medium of space itself. All things have this intelligence element. So nothing is just matter and energy. There's always intelligence that underlines and sustains this manifest phenomena. But scientists have been third force blind, even though modern physics is changing, because now the newest articles on holographic theory and information theory and physics, they realize that it comes from bit, physicist John Wheeler says. It, meaning a material energetic system, comes from bit, meaning intelligence. And this is what the mystics claim, that it, the world around us, comes from it, these spiritual levels of intelligence and design that operate in higher dimensions, that everything is created out of higher intelligence and informed from within without. So I began Uspensky's definition of psychology. You have to study the laws of three and seven. So I began, there's so many applications of these principles and the seven chakras and the seven centers. I can't go into all the details, but I studied the principles first within psychology and saw what a broader view of it, the human nature this provided to differentiate all these seven centers, the seven levels within ourselves, rather than being dualistic like modern thought. So it was over many, many years that I came to deeper and deeper understanding how these concepts could also be applied to other areas of science, like the example I gave of analyzing the periodic table, analyzing the nature of light. I could give you other examples. Another most important application of this principle that I see today is how from the heart, consciousness and vitality in the human being is distributed through three main channels to seven chakras. This is the inner metaphysical nature of the human being. You have this inner physics to you. existing in higher dimensional space, are the zero point fields that we're existing in. These are in higher dimensional space. Okay, so I can see all kinds of applications of these principles in science and psychology now. And so Uspensky says we have to study these sacred principles, the law of 3 and 7, as part of psychology. So through 30 years, I've studied those principles, and these are profoundly, it's impossible to convey the value of these basic concepts and their application to all and everything. It's a whole new way of trying to comprehend the mysteries of nature. You could study any phenomena and apply these principles. You could take, what are the sciences? Well, you could begin with physics, the basic physical science. Then you could go to chemistry. Then you could go to biology. Those are do, re, mi of the cosmic octave. And then you might go from biology to medicine or psychology, and then sociology and religion and philosophy. You could show all the sciences on an octave structure if you wanted. You can apply this concept of the sevenfoldness to different things. Human beings, some are physical. They're primarily physically oriented and sensation oriented. Others are emotionally centered. They're more concerned about emotions and relationships and feelings. Others are more intellectually centered. There are three types of human beings. A man, number four, attains a new level of that development with the awakening of consciousness and self-experience within the heart, the higher emotional center. So we can open these higher centers. Okay. So, Gurdjieff, come back. I've gone on a long time.
I just wanted to interject because you were using a term there, I just want to bring you back to one thing that you were talking about, the definitions. And I believe one of the definitions, yep, of Uspensky's definitions is that psychology is the study of the centers. And you've talked a little bit.
Oh, yeah, good.
Yeah.
Good.
So why don't you just...
Oh, good.
I mean,
see that? Yeah, you're exactly right. Excellent.
That's one of the ideas that I think, I mean, and in fact, I would say that given you're the development of the heart doctrine, that's a journey of 1,000 miles. It began with one step, because I realized that when I was first studying this material, one of the things that really struck me was that Uspensky said that there were 7 centers of intelligence within a human being, and that each of these centers had its own way of knowing, had its own locus of concentration, even though each of them was distributed throughout the body. And you started to talk about that with the intellectual center being centered in the brain, and that we had to study each of these centers, and that each of them could work with varying levels of consciousness, that most of them worked, most of the time each of the centers works mechanically, but it was possible for us to be more conscious than each of these centers individually. So why don't you talk a little bit about the centers, because I think this is a really, really important idea that in my opinion leads to an entirely different understanding of the nature of psychology of consciousness in the self.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's good. That's so good. Now, thanks for bringing it back. That was the next definition of psychology was the study of the centers.
Okay.
I was getting into the law of 3 and 7, but we'll come back to the centers. Okay, firstly, there are 7 centers, but they're in 3. There's a 3 and a 7. So firstly, you have the 3 lower centers called the moving, instinctual, no, sorry, I'll order them differently. Instinctual, sexual, and moving center, counting from the bottom. That's how they correspond to the chakras. Okay, the first is the root principle, is to relate them to the chakras a bit to help understanding. The instinctual nature is all the instinctual processes of the material body that go on by themselves. They don't have to be learned. None of us have to learn how to be the human heart or how to move our blood about. Now, all of this is instinctive, all part of the biological base in the material body. So all these are instinctual, basic physical self and being self-existence. Okay, the second is sexual center, associated with the second chakra, Svadhisthana, her favorite resort. That's the sexual nature. And Gurdjieff sees the sexual nature as profoundly important to the awakening and evolution of human consciousness, because it's through the transformation of sexual energies into higher vibrational energies that involves the attaining of these higher being bodies and the attaining of these higher faculties. So the transformation of sexual energy, even though sexual energy, he says it is the predominant force behind the mechanicalness of humankind. It is the predominant center of gravity in any social situation. He says, why do people go to movies, to theater, wherever? Its primary motivation is sexual and human affairs and encounters and all the forms and perversions of that that is involved. And people don't realize the higher sacred function of sex center in terms of the transformation of a human being. The third center is the moving center. That's associated with the navel chakra. And that's kind of your lower center of lower physical will, being able to move and learn how to move the physical body. The moving center is responsible for all learnt movement, walking, talking, all the forms. You have a sensory motor strip on your cortex. That's part of the moving instinctual center. Okay, so those are all three aspects. The moving, instinctual, and sexual centers are all in the physical nature. And then the next, you have two levels to the emotional center. Gurdjieff says that normal emotional life has a false center because most people in their lives have all kinds of unnecessary, imaginary emotions. Meaning emotions that if they were awake, they would dissolve the emotion away because it wasn't worth it at all. It's like, in a way, it's just part of all their conditioning and everything. So there's so many kind of false emotions and concerns that people invest in. So we have to work on ourselves to kind of learn. We struggle in the fourth way to learn to get rid of negative emotions and to observe our emotions and learn to be present more and give up negative emotions. And that's very important because if we want to experience a higher level of impersonal emotions, that kind of means beyond personal emotions. So with all the time, all your energies are invested in personal emotions, then you're squandering these emotional energies that are so important for the development of your astral body. Okay, so and your higher emotional center. So there's the emotional center for Gurdjieff, and a lot of work on ourselves and self-study is struggle with negative emotions and learning non-attachment or disidentification. And there's complex aspects to that self-study, but it's like all these negative emotions we have bind us. They bind our consciousness and awareness and restrict it into denser mode of being. So if we want to be free, it's like we have to resolve these conditionings and negative emotions, all these things that weigh us down, that condition our consciousness, that diminish our inner light. So we want to learn to be freer and freer of personal emotions, and we accumulate emotional energy, and that can lead to the awakening of the higher emotional center. And the higher emotion center for Gurdjieff, it would involve the experience of love, of compassion, of faith, hope, and love. He mentions the three sacred being impulses. Higher emotional center is the basic bliss of being self-existence that we can experience. It's religious emotion, it's compassion for other people, it's a capacity for love, not only in a personal way, but for the love of an animal or a flower or the world or other people. So it involves the awakening and different kinds of higher emotions we might experience. We might go through remorse of conscience, which is very important for people, because as they awaken, they see themselves more objectively, and they have remorse of conscience for things you've done, and that helps bring about change if you go through that remorse of conscience. And that kind of opens you up then more to awakening in the heart of the emotional center. And this is, as that opens, you have a different experience of your being self-existence. And that's the attainment of self-consciousness in that state is centered in higher emotional center. Then there's two levels to the, so those two centers are in the emotional level, and then we have two centers, the intellectual center and the higher intellectual center, that are in the third mode of being, in the intelligence mode. And first, Gurdjieff talks about the mind and the head and how important it is, all the acquiring knowledge and being able to adapt and do things in the world and learn about things. That's all a positive aspect to developing the mind. But we have to learn to control the mind, how much our mind normally in people is controlled by the, it could be controlled by the instinctual center and by your stomach and wanting to eat and your that nature in you. It could be controlled by your sexual function, so your preoccupation with sex. It could be controlled by your egoic will issues related to your third chakra. So most of the time, the mind in your head is controlled by your lower centers, mainly also by your emotional center. So your mind is usually controlled by the lower natures. Spensky says people seldom use their mind for really intellectual higher things. But anyway, so the idea is that there's one level of mind, and through the awakening of a human being, the first level of higher consciousness you might attain is self-consciousness, which is this awakening of the experience of self within the heart. And then the next level is the awakening of the higher intellectual centers connected to the mind and the higher faculties of the mind. That in awakening in these centers, you might perceive into the mysteries of creation. You might perceive within other dimensions. You might experiencing the processes by which creation is manifested and annihilated and manifested, and how you might experience all these cosmical phenomena and objective phenomena in nature. So there's this awakening of higher intellectual center. These that, and then, yeah. So that, and that would be associated with the seventh center. And then in the law of seven, then for the seven to become an eight, to complete the law of the octave, all seven are contained in the eight. So if a person develops all seven centers, and then there's an interval to attain to that eighth level, which is really the completion of a human being in that eighth state, where I guess you would dissolve in God bliss consciousness. So Gurdjieff then had this whole system of seven centers. Each, as you say, has its own inner taste, inner experience, its own memory, its own things that it is responsible for in life. People are not, they think they're just the one as a person, but they're not. They're really a multiple-brained being. You know, you can be controlled by your stomach, you know, your life. Many people, our lives can be controlled by our stomach or our sex organs, you know, our personal emotions. All these things can control the whole inner psychology. So the Gurdjieff teaching was this whole study of the centers and of ourself in day-to-day interaction. And I was a clinical psychologist, so it applied beautifully to counseling and clinical work and psychiatric hospital and seeing clients and such. The Gurdjieff teaching of the centers is a profound, profound teaching. And it's so valuable because also it relates to the sevenfoldness of the yogic chakra system. And it has to correspond. If it didn't, there'd be fundamental problems. It's funny, sometimes in the New Age literature, I hear people say, oh, they don't think there's seven chakras anymore. No, the newer level, there's eight, or there's nine, or there's 13 or something. And they think it's like it's throwing it out like candy. You know, they, oh, 14 chakras. Oh, I got a better system than you. I got 16. And but they don't realize, in a way, there's this profound mystery teaching that nature is sevenfoldness. And that doesn't kind of change because someone... There might be different ways of differentiating different senses and such, but it's not a simple thing to change sacred law. At least you should understand that. So anyway, so this whole teaching of the centers, and so it was all this kind of self-study we were both going through during that time, and this new understanding of psychology that was so practical, unlike anything I'd ever heard, which and more and more I understood Gurdjieff, I saw how superficial was modern psychology. And by that time, I was a professor. I had my PhD, and I taught all the theories of Freud and Adler and Jung and Maslow and the trait theorists. I taught all this stuff. Nothing was even in the same ballpark as the Gurdjieff teaching of the centers and the levels of consciousness. It's like a multidimensional teaching, whereas modern psychology is totally dominated by dualistic thinking. It's a science of behavior and the mind, and there's the conscious and the unconscious. Oh, bravo. Bravo, modern psychology. Yeah. So I realized, you know, through the... So that, anyway, to bring it back, you know, that was one for the psychology is the study of the centers, study of language, the study of self, study of the cosmos, because we have to, the final one, we have to, Gurdjieff explains, study a human being and the cosmos based on the same principles, because a human being, in a way, is a microcosm of the macrocosm. You embody the design, same design, patterns of design and creation as are embodied in the world around yourself. So sometimes he says it's easier to study the laws of 3 and 7 in ourselves and sometimes outside, but we want to study those same principles in both realms. And you see how that reached its ultimate manifestation in my own work in arriving at the concept of the zero-point origins of human consciousness. Because what I'm claiming, just like scientists today say the universe emerged from a singularity out of the quantum vacuum, I'm saying a human being similarly emerges from a singularity condition out of higher dimensional space, a hyperspace or quantum vacuum, which has a sevenfold dimensional zero-point field surrounding a central vacated space. So there's this model of kind of creation of the cosmos can be applied to the universe or to a human being. So the idea of studying man as a microcosm of the macrocosm. And that involves this higher dimensional physics of understanding what consciousness is as light and the nature of the space of the human heart and how we are quantum systems existing within zero-point fields. And the mysteries of creation. If the world isn't like this, it's what it should have been. It would have been. I wouldn't even say that. It's so inconceivably beautiful, some of the esoteric ideas about our zero-point origins. But coming back then to Uspensky, so my whole early period was studying these principles of psychology, and it just transformed my understanding and everything, you know, everything that I encountered, having this new perspective and deeper teaching. Jim.
Yeah, well,
that's kind of going, let's go back to the original question.
Well,
you asked about that early time period and encountering the fourth way and kind of this new psychology. And since then, I've been going through Spensky's definitions of psychology and kind of digressing a bit under each to explicate different type of material a bit.
Well, I was struck by one aspect of what you were saying, because you were drawing all these correspondences, and you obviously know a lot from studying these things for 30 years. But what struck me about it was that initially when we were introduced to the fourth way and we began to study ourselves systematically, I think what was most shocking, what was most astonishing, and totally intriguing was the idea that Gurdjieff put forward, was that you do not know yourself, and that everything that you do know about yourself is essentially wrong in some way, because his main contention is that our normal waking, state of consciousness can be likened to a state of waking sleep, in which we exist as somewhat like automatons, existing kind of associatively, but not sleep in the normal sense, but existing in terms of our associations, and that everything sort of originates from outside of us, and that inside we're not unified and we're not conscious. In order to understand this, we have to study ourselves, as I said earlier, not just willy-nilly, but in terms of some sort of system, and then we'll begin to realize this. And so the organizing principles of the method of the fourth way is to observe yourself. And that meant all the things that you were talking about, to study the centers, to study language, to study the laws of 3 and 7, to study yourself, and to try to remember yourself. And by that, the concept of self-remembering is very complex, and your understanding of it changes as you progress in the teaching. But initially, like, in the most simple sense, to remember yourself is just to have the sensation that I am here, and to try to hold that sensation, and to try to be aware of yourself physically, mentally, emotionally, being here now. Because most of the time we're so absorbed in various activities, intellectual, emotional, physical processes, that we don't really have anything left over to be aware of ourselves, just witnessing ourselves being here now. And I know that that for both you and for I think the great shock was to realize that this idea that we are asleep is true. Nobody in Western psychology or philosophy believes this. Nobody makes any mention of it. And yet it changes everything, because once you begin to realize how asleep you are, you also begin to realize what it would mean to be awake, or even to wake up even a little bit, and you realize that self-transformation is a possibility. And again, an idea that's not really granted any consideration in modern psychology.
No, they have no concept of this possible inner psychology of man's possible evolution, or this inner alchemy that can occur. There's no consideration of that. There's no metaphysics to modern psychology and common thought. People have no concept of these things. As you say, it's so profound, that this concept of how asleep everybody is and how it's a process of awakening, and that's a kind of mystical path that's been pursued in so many traditions, this kind of path to struggle towards awakening. And then as we awaken more, then we can attain knowledge and understanding on different level. I mean, it's interesting. Look at sleepwalking science. I mean, what I'm saying about modern psychology and neurophysiology, the whole emphasis that the brain produces consciousness in the head, I would say that's the idea and framework of asleep people. They don't understand in their own being self-awareness how ridiculous that is. You can experience that that's not so in your own inner being self-experience, in your own self-study. And if you haven't, you need to do that, and then you begin to realize consciousness isn't produced by the brain just in the head. That's not what it is. You can learn how to be all through yourself, through your blood, and be present, and be breathing, and being in yourself. I think one thing that, to me, was really important learning to do with self-remembering was working with my breath. I kind of, that is so incredibly important. If I come into the present moment in my being, my holding my sensation of being here, one of the things that becomes very obvious is like your breath. And it's through your breath that a human being is ensouled. You're ensouled through the breath and through the heartbeat and the blood flow. All that ensouls a human being. So if I want to be present, then I have to, I begin by exhaling and letting down, because most people have a chronic inhalation, an attitude they never let down. So you have to, most people let down and then learn to lower your breath into your whole lower body and nature. whereas normally in life, when people feel different negative emotions, they hold their breath. Like if people feel hurt and they're hurt about things, they hold their breath and they lock in their throat and in they get tension in the stomach and the abdomen. We do all these things to restrict our inner breathing. And in a way, these emotional habits become conditioned into the breath. So most people can't breathe properly. They can't let down and breathe fully into themselves anymore. By the time they become adults and the ego in the mind is the center of their being existence, they can't let down and experience themselves as a whole. So we have to learn in self-remembering to learn to be present in your breath and be enhancing your breath. That even in the book of Genesis, God breathes into man a living soul. So your breath life is connected to your soul life. So if people feel depressed, begin with your breath. Begin, because if people are depressed, you sit and you think about things, and while you do that often, you hold your breath, you don't breathe. You kind of sit hardly breathing and just taking short breaths here and there. If you're depressed or lack energy or need healing, you have to begin with your breath and get in touch with your deep breath and then breathe your soul life back into your body and heal yourself in an inner way through your soul breath. In Kabbalah, the five levels to the soul are all connected to breath on different levels. So in wanting to self-remember, we have to kind of connect again to it, back into our breath, and this helps to ensoul us and to enhance our sensation of being present. The soul, it's such an incredible kind of journey as I reflect on it, Jim. And just like, there's just so many aspects to all and everything that this kind of perspective and framework of ideas, it just applies to everything and anything. There's so much. It's so multidimensional and multifaceted.
Yeah, I think when I mentioned earlier, when I first read, I had read parts of your doctoral dissertation, which presented some basic ideas about the nature of consciousness from a Gurdjieff's perspective. And then I read an introductory book by Dr. Kenneth Walker, which is an excellent book called The Study of Gurdjieff's Teaching. And I read it in an afternoon. I couldn't put it down. I just read it right through. But when I was reading In Search of the Miraculous, I found the material so rich and so deep that I didn't want to just like race through it and say, oh yeah, I read that book, you know, and put it aside, because I found there were so many associations to what I was reading, and it was like seeing this entirely different way of understanding everything, you know, through this perspective that I had to sort of put it together piece by piece, and it was a very involved process. As I say, it took me months, it may have even taken me a year to read that book, because the material was just so rich. I wanted to mention one thing that we were talking earlier about the centers, and it was another idea that, the original idea that really struck me as something that just doesn't exist in modern psychology, which I think is a really profound idea, is the idea of the wrong work of centers, which Gurdjieff says that the emotional, and the moving instinctual, which are the three, that's the description he says, normally in normal consciousness, human beings are three brain beings, and he kind of puts the sexual, the moving instinctual, moving and instinctual all together to form the physical center, then they have the emotional center, and then there's the intellectual center. And he says normally we act intellectually, emotionally, and physically. And he says in each center there are various activities that characterize the functioning of those centers, but these are activities that are not proper to those centers, and that these reduce consciousness and awareness of oneself. And so in order to awaken, you have to study these processes in yourself, and you have to try to begin to go against them. And he names various processes. It's a very complex explanation of these processes. But there's nothing in modern psychology that's even remotely like this. And I remember studying
absolutely.
This. And as you say, in a clinical setting, you see these processes all the time. But not only do you see them in a clinical setting, I mean, we used to listen to therapy tapes and analyze them, and we could see them left, right, and center. But then you see them in yourself. You see how you have negative emotions and how negative emotions rule our lives and how they deplete us of energy and how they're an obstacle to consciousness and how they're based on a false sense of yourself and your own importance and just like one idea like that, like a negative emotions are one wrong work of the emotional center. But it's just such a profound idea that it really opens up worlds and I guess that
profound idea. I remember Uspensky said in all your early work on yourself, you will gain more simply from the struggle with negative emotions than that in itself makes it worth it.
The
more we can free ourselves of negative emotions and cultivate being present.
I certainly found that myself. I think there's probably no more profound idea in terms of studying myself and seeing why and how I'm asleep than understanding negative emotions, you know. And then I not only do I see them myself, but I see them in everybody else, you know, in a variety of levels. I wanted to come back to
that whole, just to stay with that for a moment.
Yep,
like
sure.
What you were saying about the whole wrong work of centers. All that, the study of that and learning the Gurdjieff system was so invaluable. And you struggle with negative emotions, imagination, because you don't want to be imagining all kinds of things. You want to be present and awake in the moment. Struggling with the turning of the mind, the formatory thinking that always goes on, learning to control the mind more. Misuse of sex energy, control by this moving instinctual centers. Yeah, through working on ourselves, it makes it such a practical psychology that brings about this kind of inner changes in your life. It integrates naturally into your life. It's a living teaching, the Gurdjieff Fourth Way teaching. I remember those early years of us studying this. It was like it was trippy. It was trippy because we both had so many realizations and insights. You have a whole system of seeing the parts of yourself and your many eyes and your personage and your negative emotions. And you kind of study all these aspects of yourself. You know, it's such a profoundly valuable inner teaching. Nothing comparable to it that I'm knowledgeable of.
No, me neither. And as you say, I don't know if I would have believed in magic before then, but I certainly believed in magic after that because it was just such a magical aspect to it all that as you say, it was completely trippy, and it was like being on LSD, but in a very focused way, and you never came down because you kept learning things and seeing through things that you'd seen before, and it was like everything seemed to be imbued with a new sense of meaning and led to new discoveries and new connections and new ideas about the possibilities of things. I just wanted to say one thing that you did mention earlier, which I had meant to comment on, which I thought was really interesting, and I didn't know that, which is that I'd forgotten that Uspensky begins the Fourth Way with that statement, that if these were just my ideas, P.D. Uspensky's ideas, you know, there wouldn't be a particular value in them. And I guess that's you know, when people listening to it, like, you might have a reaction to, you know, the speaking of all these things is like, well, you know, a couple of know-it-alls. But as you said about your own work, this isn't your work. I mean, I'd say that your work represents a great achievement in scholarship, and it certainly represents a great synthesis of a variety of types of knowledge, and you have great insight into things and really make it astounding connections. But it's not your work. You've drawn on this tradition that's existed for thousands and thousands of years, and which is continually being renewed and continually being presented to humanity in various forms. But it's so profound that the miracle of it all is that it exists, and the other miracle is that it's generally not acknowledged or understood.
Well, it's funny in a way. In a way, I would say it is a new teaching. It is a new teaching. Like, the elements in it have, it's not that they've been synthesized or piecemeal put together. It's like, although I draw from all these traditions, the way I put these whole zero-point concepts first, understanding the zero-point concept for heart, this whole way, this synthesis, in a way it's a new form of this teaching that utopia given modern physics and our understanding of science. It's, so in a way, there's something in it. It's a unique synthesis. I mean, even if you study Blavatsky, most theosophists I read, they themselves haven't grasped the zero-point concept. It's not like most theosophists even know it's there. Mm-hmm. They don't. They're more familiar with other aspects of it. But it's ways I found these gems of hidden wisdom and kind of realized the profound nature of, if you learn certain things, it opens up all kinds of understanding to you. Like if you learn the laws of 3 and 7, then as you read different things, you can understand much more. And certain, the idea of consciousness connected to the heart, that's so profound that if you begin to realize that, you begin to understand it and see it everywhere.
I was going to say that, you know, that's very interesting, and I think, you know, in subsequent programs, I'd really like to get into the process to describe that, because I think it's really interesting what you're saying about how, there's a quote from Pasteur or something like, something to the extent that observation, I'm losing it. It's something to the extent that the prepared mind makes observations possible to integrate them. I've completely forgotten the quote, but what you're describing is it's very interesting, because one of the questions I was just going to ask you, and it was, well, do you think you would have understood these things if you hadn't studied these other esoteric teachings? Like, they must have opened you up intellectually in a way to be able to see these things that other people can't see, that in say Blavatsky's teachings.
Oh yeah, I mean this understanding I've arrived at through my studies of the wide esoteric tradition, and it's me pulling out certain gems. But I'm just saying, in a way, the way I present this teaching about our zero-point origins and the heart doctrine, the distinctiveness, in a way, although these teachings are in all these other teachings, it's a unique synthesis of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's unique in. But as you say, like the gems of wisdom, the content of what is being said aren't my ideas. So that's what's important, to come back to that. Yes, and not my, it's not just my theories, it's what these secret ideas that I've realized, and then I've kind of searched them out and kind of seen it in different literatures, and kind of now can bring it together in this unique kind of zero-point teaching to try to help us understand in modern science terms what the mystics have been saying, and how to provide a new model of human consciousness that can begin to provide a framework that we can understand the physics of afterlife and higher dimensions and how these things might all work. But this is a new conception of science. I see it as a science of the future. I think that people want to travel to planets, develop your psychical powers. The science of the future will be the science of consciousness. I remember early in my studies of Carl Sagan, I'm going reading Swami Prabhupada talking to the scientists, and he says, oh, you scientists, you think you're so clever, you know, and you spend billions of dollars and you blast off and you send a little capsule up to the moon and pollute the moon and get back, and you know, and then it's a great achievement, as it is, you know, a great achievement of technology. But he says, but what is so advanced like that? He says, yogis can transfer themselves in their subtle bodies to planets of the material sky as well as to planets of the spiritual sky. Okay, so what would be a more advanced science? Blasting off a space capsule to the moon, or learning how through the inner zero-point dynamics of consciousness and the heart space to be able to travel within the subtle universe in different ways? So if there's truth to this, then this is a far more advanced science than anything in modern little bit science. See, even in modern science, the physicists don't think physics has anything to do with consciousness. No one thinks there's a physics to consciousness. It's funny. So in a way, to come back, I'm not sure. I had one more thing I wanted to say in passing. I remember Uspensky saying, we do not understand ordinary psychology, normal psychology, yet alone can we yet understand supernormal psychology. So I think we need to begin with trying to understand normal psychology and the psychology of man's possible evolution, and understanding the mechanicalness and sleepwalking state of oneself and humankind. So we need to study ordinary psychology, and it's through the study and transformation of that that it can bring us to a higher dimensional concept of what we are as human beings, and realizing that there's a profound mystery play going on here, how we come down out of higher dimensional space, and we are not at all the body, and life is far more complex than the dogmatists of the materialists conceive. In a way, the science is superficial compared with mystical teachings, far more superficial. Like, you think a scientist, he looks around the world and he thinks we live in four-dimensional space. Well, for Blavatsky, you look around the world, she says that within our space are all these other dimensions and beings interpenetrating our space everywhere, she said, if we had the faculties for perceiving them. There's a whole, all of these other dimensions and levels that scientists haven't even begun to conceive. The mystic says there's seven dimensions to existence. The scientist thinks there's only one and thinks he's clever. You know, in a way, we study the shoe and we don't study the inner human being. Or Prabhupada used to say we study the overcoat, but we don't understand the inner man or the inner being. Mm. Prabhupada says, you know, there's a science of God consciousness. I would say there's a science of God consciousness, okay? But where is this science of God consciousness? No one has any idea what it involves, really, in the mainstream. No one has any concept of it, or even of it as a possibility. Modern psychology has had such a kind of rigid kind of system of psychology over the past century, and the denial of all these super aspects to human beings.
Yeah, it's interesting that you brought up that quote from Uspensky, because I was going to mention that too, but that, and that was one of the things that really struck me. I think we were both interested in paranormal psychology when we first, before we started studying the fourth way. And I remember reading that comment from Uspensky, and by that point I was already quite convinced that, you know, that this was completely different order of thought, and that this was really, this was a system that really was a key to understanding so many things I didn't understand. But I really liked that you know, that he said, you know, don't be, as much as it's important to understand the supernormal psychology, first of all, you have to understand the normal psychology. And I realized that, gee, you know, like, just studying my normal, so-called normal psychology, that I was a long way from, you know, even beginning to think about the supernormal psychology. But now it's interesting that 30 years later, you know, that's where you've arrived at, when you have arrived at this whole model of human beings as multidimensional beings. And now you have something to say about supernormal psychology, because you have a much better understanding of normal psychology from these perspectives.
Yeah, and I think I actually experience a supernormal aspect of myself. You know, it's not something I can prove, but in a way, what I talk about, I experience in my inner being in a different way. Yeah, my inner self-awareness of being kind of different than it used to be. I can understand the, you know, Gurdjieff mentions the idea of man number 4, 5, 6, and 7, and, you know, that we could, there are many levels, and we can all develop in our being. We need to begin where we are and strive with this idea in mind, strive towards the perfection of our own being. Gurdjieff describes that, striving for our own self-perfection in terms of being. And to introduce that into life is profoundly valuable. And then to do that, we need a system or a teaching that helps us do that, like a language and, you know, a way of studying things. And the Gurdjieff-Uspensky teaching is an absolutely invaluable basic psychological teaching. So well, the first, so maybe I see we're likely coming down to a few minutes left,
yeah,
here, Jim. But so that was really fun. I enjoyed that today. I was neat remembering the Spensky definitions of psychology and how much each one of them entails. You could kind of elaborate on any one of them.
Yeah, and as I say, the fascinating thing to me is that over the years is that the more you study these things, the more depth and the more comprehensive each of these ideas and axioms become, because you have such a deeper understanding of it all. So,
we need to wrap her up. We're a little bit over, but phenomenal show, guys.
Right,
I'll let
yeah,
you close.
Thanks, Don. Okay, we'll be back in 2 weeks' time.
We'll pick it up in a couple of weeks and get on to some other things.
Yeah, and those out there who've enjoyed our show, please email us or encourage others to listen. And I'll try as best I can with Jim's help to convey some of these ancient mystery teachings and to have these explorations of the mysteries. Goodbye.
Thanks, Chris.